I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. Prior to founding Kiva, Mick worked in high-tech product development at Motorola, Apple, and the online grocery company Webvan. Mick is a graduate of MIT and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I want to start by understanding the traditional warehouse. Could you describe briefly the day in the life of a warehouse worker?
Yeah, the traditional warehousing, at least what I was experiencing in the late 90s, was characterized by a lot of conveyors and forklifts and other static, stationary shelving devices. Classically, a pick worker would grab a tote or a cart or some some RF picking device that might be mounted to their wrist, and they would follow the instructions and walk from location to location in the warehouse to find those items. And sometimes they pick an order at a time or multiple orders at a time, but they're going out to gather the inventory, bring it back to somebody else who's then going to do the pack out. And when we started Kiva, we turned that whole equation on its head and said, what if all of the inventory in the warehouse could walk and talk on its own and just come to you, the pick-pack worker?
A typical pick worker can walk 5 to 10 miles a day and spend, 70% of their time walking around the warehouse. I've heard you say before that regarding the experience of a worker, not only is this an unproductive way to fill orders, it's also an unfulfilling way to fill orders.
Yeah, it can be a kind of a rough job, and we're talking about direct labor in the factory setting that's probably being paid on the order of $10, $12, $14 an hour. And it's interesting for a while, but then it becomes pretty routine pretty quickly. Part of the unfulfilling part, at least, is that a lot of the technologies and existing processes don't allow you to do your job well. So you get to a location and you're supposed to get a red T-shirt and you're out of red T-shirts. And so then you end up spending all this extra time looking for where did they put the extra red T-shirts. And obviously, we tried to change that whole equation with our approach.
With Kiva Systems, instead of the workers going to get the inventory comes to them. Can you describe that process briefly?
Sure. So instead of walking out to a location to get the T-shirts, we send mobile robots that travel on the ground out to get underneath a mobile shelving pod. It's an inventory pod that contains lots of different items. We pick it up just an inch or two off the ground, and then we drive that shelving unit all the way over to where the pick worker is standing. And then they present themselves in a serial fashion in front of the pick worker so that every 6 seconds they can reach out their hand and pick another item of inventory. It allows the pick worker access to every single item of the inventory without moving their feet.
How fast do these robots move around the warehouse? What's the mile per hour?
It's interesting. It's super slow. What we did is model the robots after the speed that humans would be walking, say, for example, in a grocery store, about 3 feet per second. And so when you see a bunch of them in the building, they're all kind of moving at a walking pace, yet they're getting a lot of work done very quickly because the human operator experiences a continuous pick face in front of them.
The warehouses look like a mini city on a grid system. It's like traffic, like cars moving around. How much did maps and the idea of automobile traffic play into your vision of what the warehouses would look like?
The way we approach it is less about like highway traffic and more about just a reservation-based system. So as they drive, they're reserving small stickers in this grid system, and as they get to the next sticker, they release the last sticker. Our software control system is probably more better described as an air traffic control system, which is deciding who gets to go when, where, and why. And then that creates this fluid set of motion amongst all of the robots.
Where does the name Kiva come from?
It is a Hopi Indian word that means meeting place of the ant people, or loosely ant colony. And so we use the term Kiva because our original logo was an ant carrying a package. It was kind of like the ant colony at your picnic that carries off all of your food.
Also, ants are complex organisms who are very strong. I think an ant can carry multiple times its weight.
True. I hadn't thought about the individual ant strength analogy until you pointed it out. But yeah, our robots weigh about 250 pounds and they carry a 1,000-pound payload around of shelving. But the real metaphor that I like is at the systems level, an ant colony is a very robust organism and it's really hard to kill. Mm. Once you get ants in your kitchen, really hard to get rid of them. So we are similar. Our approach to solving this warehouse inventory picking problem is to use hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of robots in a building, all with a little bit of information, but collectively very capable of getting the work done and very robust.
One of the things that Kiva Systems does is track the popularity of a product. So let's say it's Valentine's Day. There'll be more pink candies being procured or fulfilled than Christmas time. So the robots are able to, the shelves are able to be moved to farther away from the human operators than those products that are more popular.
That's right. One of the side effects of making everything mobile in the warehouse is that you can now dynamically and adaptively tune the layout of the warehouse. And so as more chalky pink candy is being ordered, all of that stuff kind of moves to the front of the warehouse. But the day after Valentine's Day, as nobody's ordering that stuff, it starts to drift to the back of the warehouse and get out of the way. And traditional warehouses would have tackled that problem by bringing a crew of humans in over the weekend to reslot the warehouse and move all that stuff around. And in our system, it just happens automatically.
I'd like to talk about the cost of the robots. A startup kit for these robots is, you know, $1 to $2 million. And if you have a warehouse of, let's say, 1,000 robots, that's, you know, close to $20 million. And it takes you, you know, 6 months to plan and set up the grid system. How did you justify the cost to potential customers in the early days?
There's a pretty well-known kind of trade-off, which we call the 2-year CapEx versus OpEx trade-off. I'll gladly spend $1 million if I'm going to save $500,000 a year for the next 2 years. Mm. And if you can hit that 2-year CapEx-OpEx trade-off, the automation projects tend to get approved pretty quickly. And in our case, to bring this disruptive solution to market, we had to do a lot of innovation around the business itself. We had to approach our potential clients with a brand new pricing model that took the risk out of the equation for them. So when they were thinking about converting from a conveyor-based system to a Kiva, we knew it would work, but they weren't quite so comfortable. So we'd say, look, if we get all the way to the end and you still don't like it, you can send it back.
You mentioned disruption. Kiva is a disruptive technology. It's not just a bunch of robots delivering products in a traditional warehouse. You really have changed the paradigm of the warehouse. What other companies do you look to who have been equally disruptive in their own industries?
There's a lot. Along the way, we used to think about who else has dealt with similar disruptive challenges when they grew their business. And companies like Southwest Airlines would come to mind. People always laugh about low-cost Southwest Airlines, but yet it's the only profitable airline over an extended 10 to 15-year period. And how do they do that? Well, they just take a very robust and simple approach. They use one aircraft, a 737, for all their flights. They originally had an open seating policy, so people really would hustle to get in and get their seats. And they took a very fun approach to flying, too. Another one we always used to talk about was FedEx. Today, you think about the ability to overnight a package from almost anywhere in the world next day. And that capability didn't exist, you know, 20 or I guess it was about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was unheard of.
We were talking about convincing customers to adopt Kiva. And your first customer was Staples. How did that happen?
The introduction, so we identified Staples as a likely consumer of the Kiva solution, and we had emailed into just about everybody we knew from every angle over there without much success. But when we were out seeking venture funding, the team at Bain Capital actually was able to introduce us to Staples.
Bain Capital was your investor, but they weren't among the early investors whom you approached. You got about 100 no's before you finally met them. What was the appetite among venture capitalists when you were presenting this idea?
The first few years would have been 2002 and 2003. I was still living in Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so naturally, I was traveling Sand Hill Road, meeting with a lot of venture teams out there. And, it wasn't a great time for raising money. They were still licking their wounds from the dot-com crash of 2001. And we were a hardware play. And so at this point, they were looking for the next software company or some internet-type play that could grow quickly on unlimited amount of capital. And so, yes, to your point, we had the door closed in our face quite a bit. And they used to say things like, you're going to need $100 million to get this thing to cash flow break even, and then some. So I became convinced, actually, in those early years that maybe venture capital was not the right funding model for Kiva, this capital-intensive business. So I end up working my network, friends of friends, to find some investors that got it and that wanted to take a risk. I managed to meet up with a gentleman named Sam Kinney, who was one of the co-founders of Free Markets, which was a 1999 very successful internet startup. Anyway, I met up with him. He introduced me to additional co-founders and early employees of Free Markets, and we started to put together kind of a $1.6 million Series A round to get the company to do a proof of concept.
How firm was your conviction that you thought this was viable and this would work, especially in the face of multiple no's?
I knew that it could work, but, you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, CEO, all that stuff, I probably didn't appreciate all of the challenges that were going to be involved in building the company. But you have that kind of that naivete that actually makes you think you can do it, which is useful, very useful, actually.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems. We'll hear more from Mick Mounts coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. So I want to talk some more about the early days of the company. You were sleeping on friends' couches, and what was your burn rate personally?
Burn rate on me physically, or burn rate cash-wise, the checkbook, all of that?
You tell me.
So the reason I was sleeping on people's couches is because I was keeping the burn rate near zero. I remember in that year, I think it was in 2003, something like 300 days on the road that year, 299 on other people's beds or couches, and one night in a Red Roof Inn because I just couldn't drive any further and had to pull over. And it said $29.99 for the night.
What was your social life at the time with such a nomadic existence?
I was single, dating at the time, so I didn't have a lot that tied me down or restricted me from kind of taking this leap with both feet.
We talked before about Staples being your first customer. How important was that in being a catalyst for other retailers to come on board?
Yeah, so Staples is a very interesting story. We had identified a list of about 25 customers that we just thought, if all of these customers are using Kiva, then we've arrived. And Staples was on that list. And we were pleasantly surprised at the conversation when they came by. Only kind of in the ensuing year did we put together the reasons why they acted so quickly. But they were in a hyper-competitive space, just office supplies, and it was them against Office Depot, against Office Max, against Corporate Express. All of these guys are effectively selling the same 3M yellow Post-it notes and red pens. And so how do you differentiate in that environment? Well, it's through your pick, pack, and ship fulfillment capability. And so Staples saw our stuff and thought, geez, if this works, we probably ought to know about it, and wouldn't it be great if Office Depot didn't know about it? And so in that competitive context, they moved very quickly to try it. And then we quickly followed with Walgreens, later with Zappos and Gap and some others. And I think there was a critical mass building. You could see some of the leading online retailers using our stuff. And so that became kind of a self-fulfilling thing where most people who wanted to solve this problem would come and talk to us because we had a lot of the key accounts.
There were other people who started Kiva with you, including Pete Warman and Raffaello D'Andrea. How do you know them?
So Pete Warman is my roommate from MIT. He was teaching computer science and as it related to e-commerce, and he knew exactly how to make this thing work from a software standpoint. And I met Raff through another friend of ours, Mary Elaine Vandermeulen, who was sitting across the hall from him at Cornell as a professor. I showed him what we wanted to do with these robots, and this built on everything that he had been doing in his academic career with controlling complex systems. He's a controls expert that can make these systems operate robustly.
One example of a robot that he built is a soccer robot.
That's right. You'd put five autonomous robots on a little mini soccer field against some other university, and the 10 robots would go at it autonomously. And his RoboCup teams at Cornell were winning every year. And when I showed Raff what we were working on, it was almost like falling off a log compared to playing soccer. We had a controlled environment. We could put down a grid. Nobody can go in there. There's no opponent that you have to outguess. You just have to control these things. So he signed up pretty quickly.
You mentioned that one of your co-founders was your roommate at MIT. You've had a couple of other friends join the company and also family members. Your father worked at the company. What was his role?
That's right. So I would talk to my dad about every other weekend, and I could tell he was getting more and more interested and getting kind of sucked into the process. And one day I just said, hey, why don't you just stop what you're doing and just move out. He was in Phoenix at the time. Move out to Boston and work on this. It'd be much more fun. You can do it full time. I don't have to call you every Sunday. So he took me up on it and came out, worked in our supply chain group using his logistics background.
You have one sister who's a helicopter pilot for the military, but you have another, your older sister has joined Kiva.
She was a part-time assistant in our HR team for a number of years. And my brother-in-law, her husband, had a PhD in robot path planning. Go figure. So he and my sister Cindy and family moved from the Chicago area to Boston. She was the sole person in our HR department almost up until like employee number 100, all part-time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics fulfillment company. Customers include Crate and Barrel, Timberland, The Gap, and Staples. Kiva Systems was acquired by Amazon in spring 2012 for $775 million. Incidentally, in 2008, you were watching the Beijing Olympics, and you've mentioned that the opening ceremony was in some way a parallel to what you were doing at Kiva. How is that?
Right. So in 2008, my wife and I are watching the Beijing opening ceremonies on TV, and they show 2,000 people on the stadium floor making art. And I said to my wife, hey, that was the idea for Kiva. Just put lots and lots of people on the warehouse floor, and they can do some very interesting collaborative things. Of course, we didn't end up using people. We used robots to do it. But I was fascinated by the opening ceremonies there because they were able to make some incredible artwork, and I was told it was all done without computers, but just peer-to-peer with them working it out amongst themselves and coordinating.
I want to go back to when you hatched the idea for Kiva. You had been working at Webvan, which is the online grocery delivery company that raised hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital and went bankrupt, perhaps because they were too early for their time and they didn't have this logistics framework baked into it. Could you describe how you came up with the idea briefly?
Sure. I mean, my experience at Webvan was the genesis. That's where I was able to experience at least the problem firsthand. That company was taking online grocery orders, much like a Peapod or in New York City, a Fresh Direct. And what would happen is the cost of fulfilling the order, delivering the order, and having the customer support relationship, those total costs would completely overwhelm the margin on that grocery order. And so clearly, part of the reason the company went out of business was it was losing money on every order. And my job at Webvan was to think about next-generation fulfillment solutions. The internet was new. E-commerce was new. There hadn't been much kind of clean thinking around what does it mean to get one green T-shirt, one toothpaste, one can of soup in a tote, a box, or a bag. So this notion of each-based picking I felt was unsolved, and I racked my brain for a year over there trying to think about how to do this. The existing solutions just didn't stack up, and about a year and a half later, it was still bugging me, and that's how that's when I really got started on the problem.
We talked about Webvan's influence on Kiva's development, but you also worked at Apple starting in 1996. You were at Apple for about 3 years, and you were helping to move technology onto their desktop platform. This is also when Steve Jobs returned to Apple. Similar to Apple, at Kiva, you really control every step of the product chain, of the design, the aesthetic, the software, the robot operators, the stickers, everything from cradle to grave. And that's somewhat reflective of what Apple did. Can you explain that?
For sure.
That linkage?
That's right. So we're bringing a very complex solution to market, and we're going to put this in a customer's warehouse. So it just has to work. And so we decided to take the same approach that Apple did when they would develop a technology like the original iPod, for example. The reason it was in some sense so successful is Apple not only made the iPod, but they were involved in the USB interface to the Mac. They made the logic board for the Mac. They made the operating system that ran on the logic board, and they made the iTunes software that connected to the iPod. So rather than having to think through and deal with all those technologies, the consumer was able to just listen to music.
What are some of your memories of Steve Jobs? Like, are there any, random stories that come to mind from those days?
You learn a lot through osmosis when you see somebody like that. And I kind of had a front row seat for the turnaround. And when he got back in 97, the company was working on all kinds of different projects. And one of the things I remember was that meeting where he rolled out the new 2x2. We make desktops and portables, and we make consumer and professional. And if you're not in one of those four boxes, you can leave. Everything else is going to be shuttered. And luckily, I was in the desktop professional box. Mm-hmm. And then he said in that same meeting, so which one of these are we? We have this product, what are we missing? We're missing the consumer desktop. And so he had already developed the thesis and was working on his iMac vision. What I also remember about those days at Apple was everything became even more secret and super secret. And so I would, the guy in the product marketing manager in the office next to me would be working on the iMac and couldn't tell me anything about it, whereas only, you know, a year earlier we were all working on these projects together and sharing experiences.
How did you feel about that level of secrecy within the same company?
It was different, but it was completely understood that, geez, if your customer knows that the next version of the product is coming out, they're not going to buy the current version. So it was understood why.
Any other anecdotes, impressions of him?
Well, when I was working there, I used to tell my friends in the Bay Area, it's very interesting because he's so smart and his, you know, his passion and vision for the industry is really compelling, but I think he succeeds despite himself. And that, you know, with just small changes to the way he treats people or leads, he could be even more effective.
You founded Kiva Systems in 2003 and were acquired by Amazon in 2012. How did that acquisition happen? Did they approach you? Were they a customer of yours? To begin with?
Amazon directly was not a customer of Kiva. In fact, that was the number one question that we would get from other clients or prospective investors was, hey, why isn't Amazon using this? But in our sales efforts, we would make the kind of annual trip out to Seattle to try to convince Amazon that they ought to use a Kiva system in one of their warehouses for pick, pack, and ship. And in 2012, the conversation got more interesting as they said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we'd like to own the whole company.
Did you think that maybe they would try to build it themselves in-house?
That's always a real possibility, but I wasn't too worried about that because we'd been at it for, say, 8 or 9 years at that point.
Yeah.
And we developed a ginormous portfolio of patents, and we've solved a lot of hard problems. So even patents aside, some of the things we figured out how to do are very hard to learn. And so given that technology challenge, we weren't too worried about other people copying it.
At the time Amazon acquired you, you had been fulfilling orders for Diapers.com and Zappos, who were owned by Amazon. So perhaps that helped.
It did help. We think it helped. So for a moment there, we thought about changing our marketing tagline to say, buy a Kiva, get bought by Amazon. Mm. We didn't end up doing that because then, of course, it happened to us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. I want to talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, in a U.S. Army hospital. My dad was in the military, so we had that classic Army brat upbringing where we were moving every couple of years somewhere new. I think I had 9 different schools by the time I finished high school or 12th grade.
What kind of child were you? What kind of kid were you?
I guess the funniest thing I can think about my childhood was when I was an adult already in my 20s, I took the Myers-Briggs test, and it comes out ENTJ.
What does that mean?
No, ENTP. So ENTJ is this classic leader profile where people who run companies, but I'm not that. I'm ENTP, which the tagline for that personality type was called One Exciting Challenge After Another. And I was showing it to my folks, said, supposedly this is my personality. And they started reading it, and they burst out laughing at the paragraph where it said, as a child, the ENTP, when asked to take out the trash, will spend the next 2 days trying to invent a system for the trash to take out itself rather than just doing the chore. And so they're like, that's you. That's absolutely you.
And along those lines, you tried to create, when you were, 11 years old, an automated process for doing your homework rather than you doing it yourself?
Yeah, my mom later, when I was running Kiva, sent me some old little clippings from the scrapbook kind of stuff that said, it was an essay, what do you want to invent? And I wanted to invent a machine that would do all my homework. And I feel like that was actually what I ended up working on at Apple, was my homework machine, the Mac.
Your parents were in the military. How were they as parents? Were they militaristic? Or
Probably quite the opposite. They just gave us a ton of support for whatever it was that we were interested in. So, my father and my mother were role models and influential, inspirational in different ways. So my dad was the kind of hard work ethic, always had to be doing something productive. And then he also taught me sports, right? So he was a college football player at the University of Illinois, and I developed a love of sports by hanging out with him. And then my mother had a scientific curiosity, so she would take me, for example, into the laundry room at age 7 and turn out the lights and say, watch this, and open the dryer drawer and dryer door, and all the clothes would spark as she was pulling them out. Mm. And so there was a lot of little memories like that that contributed, I think, to both my competitive nature through playing sports and working hard, and then my scientific curiosity that my mother kind of instilled.
You used to exercise a lot before you started Kiva and having kids.
That's right.
Now you have no time. You did yoga. You played baseball at MIT for 4 years. You ran triathlons.
Yeah, it kind of goes away when you have a startup and you're doing 80 to 100 hours a week. But so I was fortunate in that my early few years at Kiva, with my schedule, I could really get in great shape. And I was in great shape when I started the company. And, of course, now with three little ones at home, my priority is to try to get some time with them in the morning and in the evening before they get to bed.
I've been told that you drink a lot of coffee. Just how much are we talking about?
Well, so the coffee, the caffeine is a mental stimulus for me. I actually did an experiment 1 year where I tried to go a whole year without caffeine and without alcohol. And it turns out I ended up going a year and a half without alcohol. I didn't miss it, didn't need it. But the caffeine, for after 4 months, I could barely complete a sentence. And so I had to start drinking coffee again. So I'll have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, kind of the perpetual cup, and then switch to maybe one or two Mountain Dews in the afternoon.
Mountain Dew because?
The caffeine.
Mm.
And the sugar, I guess. But then I need the sugar, too.
And you like Lucky Charms cereal?
Yeah, there was a period there when we were getting the company going that I felt that not only Lucky Charms was a nutritious breakfast, but that it was having some impact on our ability to win new deals.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Mick Mounts, the co-founder of Kiva. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year that we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. and you weren't being very successful in raising that money. So then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity. And then we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with, had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of, I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that, and we basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people, and then at the end of the process, he asked me to be the CEO, and I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else, and it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and I had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of 91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the
U.S.? My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's family that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so, but it was, you know, I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is an emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So when you compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else. And so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was sort of the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts. And then, of course, there were competitive issues in that large parts of the payment industry, you know, are fairly, nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard, duopoly saw us as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about what the regulatory regime for this was. So it was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements, or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The biggest one was people were just not using them, and so you know, was the question was, you know, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, you know, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar. And in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon. And you know, the reason, you know, $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who'd like to have that $100 bill. And so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested initially about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late '99, but then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes.
So you were very lucky to get in and raise that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board, but there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day where, you know, we're exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing account of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies, which had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it, if for no other reason than that gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor is doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, "Oh, welcome to our service," and then suggested that we should maybe talk, and we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how were you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different, very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, and then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and it was completed in October towards the end of 2002. So we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. The clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We had raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that?
That's so megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was PayPal was the new world currency, and I think that turned out. You know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.